My talk today, or the paper that I prepared today, is an attempt to think about how Chinese thought global capitalism when it impinged upon them when it became unavoidable for them to think through its various categories and terms. Okay, and so I'm appreciative of what the two papers we just heard, because I think, although my paper is very, very different, I think they actually do in some weird way speak to one another. Okay, so my remarks are organized around the historical philosophical problem that we can name following Hegel, the world historical. But unlike Hegel, who abstracted the philosophical historical from material historicity, I'm specifically concerned with the world historical as the way in which abstraction was incorporated into the material and ideological historicity of life. That is, the way in which abstraction became a particular mode of inquiry into and a way of apprehending material historical experience. And the commodity form could be one of those abstractions, among many others. I begin then with the problem of the world historical as a problem that emerged at a particular moment in time rather than one that existed in latent form, ready to become manifest, to converge or diverge at any time. In this idiom, the world historical cannot be taken to mean commonsensically a latent, suprahistorical or eternalizing force. It cannot mean purely an endurance or persistence through the empty time of history as chronology. It cannot be a posited existence whose emergence need not be accounted for materially, historically, or theoretically. Rather, the world historical is a particular form of temporality, a particular type of historicity, a particular production of knowledge. If we do not specify this clearly, evoking the term and concept of the world historical or global capitalism could merely confirm the world as we think we know it today, as if all of history were inevitably leading us to converge with or diverge from the present moment. Again, against this logic of confirmation and teleology, I want to claim that to understand the problem of the world historical, we need to understand the problem of the world and the historical in their conjoining. That is, we need to defamiliarize both. In this sense, the world historical is a mode, a logic, a temporality, requires that we see that it names a conjuncture, a particular form of historicity, rather than the unmasking manifestation of a latent tendency present since the dawn of time. Naming the world historical a conjuncture as a tendentially totalizing form requires that we see that once the world and the historical become conjoined, inextricably interlocked, not only by abstract logic or by contingency, but by the material lived necessity, we enter an extended moment of cotemporality. And as I see it then, the task of an inquiry into this cotemporality is to understand the particularities of that conjuncture, which in part means to reanimate for our present conjuncture a genuine sense of possibility and urgency. So my discussion is shaped by how we might understand how and when the world and the historical became inextricably linked in Chinese thought and material practice, and thus how and when comparison and comparability became the inevitable mode of apprehending this question. One abstract answer to this question is that comparison, thus the world conjoined to the historical, is an important modern ideology in that it can make present in a defamiliarizing way rather than reinscribing essences as if always already known. But meanwhile, my short historical answer to the question about the unavoidability of comparability and thus of the conjoining of the world and the historical in China would be that comparison is unavoidable because, as Liang Qichao, a leading Chinese intellectual of the late 19th, early 20th century, observed with mordant humor and knowing resignation, even if you are not interested in the world is interested in you. Liang's observation in the opening years of the 20th century was situated at a moment when Euro-American and increasingly Japanese capitalist imperialism was carving China up like a melon in the parlance of the day. Liang's insight points to an important shift in China's relation to the world, as well as the world's relation to China. Following Liang, my claim is that beginning from the late 19th and early 20th centuries, China's situation in the emerging world of capitalist expansion leaves Chinese no choice but to see and narrate themselves and continually to reconceive of China in the world and thus comparatively. China is so situated explicitly and unavoidably by virtue of the global imperialist extension of capitalist relations of production, semi-colonization, and global circulations of knowledges and ideologies. It is so situated implicitly and unavoidably because the challenges keenly experienced and discussed by most thinking people since that time forward always were articulated through and by comparative thinking, including by comparison to China's newly and continually relativized past. This point was constituted in the late Qing and beyond through and by the necessity of re-narrativization, albeit not in the sense of Hayden White's linguistic modes or Paul Ricoeur's retreat from philosophy. Rather, here, narrative indicates an insistence on what Walter Benjamin calls the now time, a temporality that comprises a struggle between different forms of temporalization, past, present, future, within everyday life and experience. In this sense, narrative becomes the site of politics, where politics refers to a conflictual mode of and in the historicization and lived experience of time. On the historical and narrative question of China, then, as we know, China has always been situated in a world. However, it has not always been situated in the world. What I mean in this distinction is that the nature of the world and its historical valence, its material and narrative logic, came to signify differently by the late 19th century. This is because the world itself had become, as it were, world historical, for China as for everyone else. Simply then, my contention is that we must see the world or the global or global capitalism as not as some pre-existing inert space or process ready to be revealed, but rather as an historical logic in constant and dynamic becoming. By the same token, this ever-transforming historical logic is one that Chinese have had to interpret, cope with, and help shape and reshape, have had to narrate and re-narrate and to practice from the moment when participation in the world historical became unavoidably necessary from the mid to late 19th century onwards. So I have four conjunctural moments. I may get to two of them. We'll see. But the first is then the late Qing, the world, the historical and conjuncture. And so I go back to 1897 when Liang Qichao, my aforementioned journalist philosopher, wrote that what is perhaps the first Chinese analysis of the relationship between the expansionism of Euro-America and Euro-American cultural production as a form of necessary narrative relation. In explaining the tight nexus between ideology, cultural production, and conquest, violent imperialism, Liang wrote, quote, "I read Western newspapers and their report on the disorder of the Chinese polity. This has been going on for the past few decades. Since September or October last year, 1896, in other words, they have been even more openly and brazenly publicizing how wild and uncivilized the Chinese are, how ignorant and dishonest, how empty Chinese Confucianism is. The meaning is clear. They will move to eliminate China at once," unquote. What Liang was pointing to was that China appears in a particular light when read through imperialist ideologies of superiority and advancement, or through the culturally productive binary categories of civilized and uncivilized, intended to valorize the former in its Eurocentric capitalist form and denigrate the latter in its multiple non-Western forms. China appears differently then when seen in the light of how the ideological production of backwardness by Euro-American print media and scholarship for peoples in the world, whether in Asia, Africa, or elsewhere, invites and results in the justifications for invasion and conquest. It appears differently when we see cultural backwardness as a produced ideological form rather than an existing essence. This produced ideological form, as Liang lamented, was being insinuated into the quotidian lives of newspaper readers around the world, becoming thereby a type of commonsensical knowledge. In this late 19th century moment in China, for the very first time, someone as astute as Liang Qichao could realize, to his certain dismay, that China was not uniquely targeted as the object of Euro-American derision, colonial conquest, and desire. Rather, China was one of many so targeted, and indeed was merely one part of a global pattern of imperialist conquest and ideological denigration that imminently was to swallow and attempt to consume China and others in its messy embrace. This new perception that cultural production was helping to produce not just a new world, but the new world of capitalist, imperialist, colonial expansion was a shatteringly novel idea. By summer 1901, just as the punitive expedition that ended the Boxer Rebellion was winding down and the final indemnity provisions of the Boxer Protocol were being hammered out between the Qing court and the eight allied powers, Liang Qichao organized his hitherto fragmentary new perceptions into a huge new essay entitled, quote, "The New Rules for Destroying Countries," 灭国新法论. The heart of the essay is a survey of the modern world, of modern world history, from the perspective of those peoples and states which had been or were then in the process of being destroyed by what he called the new rules, the Xinfa. To derive the new rules, Liang specifically comparatively cites the recent histories of Egypt, India, Poland, South Africa, and the Philippines. In each case, as Liang writes, non-state foreign actors have used the modern methods of indebtedness, government advisors, financial manipulations, intervention in domestic politics, and monopolization of commercial routes and finance as ways to insinuate themselves into a country and its systems, thus to facilitate an eventual takeover. Liang warns, one does not have to be directly invaded by a military force to be wiped out. One can be eaten away from the inside and outside simultaneously. He alerts his readers that China is just then undergoing this type of what he calls formless dismemberment through the Boxer indemnities indebting China to Britain, Japan, and the United States. The acceptance into the Qing polity of foreign advisors, the ceding of railway and mining rights for commercial expansion, along with the extensions of special privileges accorded to foreigners in the treaty ports and other areas, have allowed China to continue to have in name a sovereign government, but the reality is that China is being wiped out. Now, this is a powerful the new rules for destroying countries is a powerful interpretation of the global modern from the perspective of those who would be its subjugated targets. Liang sees the world historical in a contemporary globalizing form as a tendentially unifying, albeit materially uneven and disjunct temporality and spatiality. This globalizing form unifies the world and the historical under the incessant drive of capitalist expansion manifested in violent imperialism and colonialism, even while it disunifies and creates global unevenness between the world's fractions and within nation states themselves as well. Indeed, Liang's final injunction in the essay is that the new rules, having been executed in various ways in the locations he surveys, precisely constitute the conditions of a world historical modernity as a global temporality defined by the new structuring structures of imperialist colonialism, then converging upon China as they were also converging upon others. As far as Liang Qichao was concerned, it was only through the recognition of how the rules constituted the very modern historical moment in which China participated and was enmeshed that Chinese intellectuals and the Chinese state could fully grasp their contemporary situation, as well as reconceive their history, thus to devise strategies to move beyond it. I'm going to skip further comments about the late Qing. and move to the May 4th moment, 1919. This is the year, centenary year of May 4th. I've been on the May 4th centenary circuit now for, there's a global circuit of centenary 1919s, and I'm fully in it. But let me just say that the coerced incorporation of capitalism into China and China into capitalism over the course of the 19th century produced by the late century the coexistence of different and uneven forms of economic, cultural, and temporal practices within China and between China and other places. Internally, these unevennesses could include the advanced urban spaces of industrialization, consumption, leisure, such as Shanghai, alongside the newly relativized backward rural spaces of poverty, illiteracy, and bound-footed women. The civilized spaces of the Euro-American, Japanese, Chinese, capitalist, bourgeois, comprador order, juxtaposed to the uncivilized anarchy of Chinese usurious landlord disorder, among many others. These endlessly created and reproduced unevennesses produce products precisely of the global capitalist world historical conjuncture within and without, were actualized in politics, economy, and culture through a logic of polyrhythmic everyday life, that is, lives that only could be lived by contrapuntal comparison. This was a necessary condition, not a contingent one. By May 4th, we have the generative inauguration of the mass as a political subject and a subject of politics. And so the May 4th movement of 1919 created a social rupture in a new time of politics. That is, if historical temporality had been rethought in a predominantly statist mode in the late Qing period, just 20 years before, leading to an attempt to construct a new state from the detritus of the Qing Empire, the May 4th marks the moment at which historical temporality was fundamentally desacralized, removed from the exclusivity of the state or its bureaucrat intellectual instantiation, and at least potentially relocated to the everyday cultural and economic lives of the masses. This new struggle came to be inscribe politics as insistently future-oriented and mass-generated, ushering in a host of new political and cultural possibilities and potentialities, and many of these new possibilities and potentialities, as well as the inherent limitations of them, were framed within a new temporal spatial order named semi-colonialism, a term that came to designate not merely an incompletion, that is, incomplete colonization, but more philosophically, precisely the lived social and everyday experience of global capitalist imperialism in China in the post-Versailles Treaty period. I have a lot to say about semi-colonialism. I won't say it here. Part of it is in a book I recently published called The Magic of Concepts, published in 20th century, 2017. Okay, so... But one of the ways in which I think about semi-colonialism is that it names the lived experience of modernity as a universal logic of global capitalism, a universal condition that can only, however, be lived locally, in local time, in local space. And so it forces people to live their lives comparatively by virtue of experiencing some form of colonization. And semi-colonialism could, of course, just be another name for colonization, but it calls, it calls particular attention to the multiple clashing levels of life lived at quotidian, local, national, and global scales simultaneously. I then move on, I'm wrapping up, I then move on to the next conjunctural moment, which is, of course, the revolutionary years of Mao, during which I posit that the massification of life that had happened in 1919 and that had had been inaugurated in 1919 and became part of a lived experience of life becomes part of the grand project and grand failure of Maoism insofar as its grand project is to reconcile the quotidian with the time of politics, which happens not in the quotidian. And this reconciliation requires a certain kind of politics in command, as we know was one of the great slogans of the Mao years, and to live your life politically day in and day out, hour in, hour out, became an impossibility. And so that became part of the reason that Maoism collapsed. That's my analysis. And this attempt to, in socialism, to try to to politicize your way out of the unevennesses of global capital had to collapse and did collapse, which yields then the new historical turn in 1989, the moment, as Wang Hui put it, where the capitalist and the socialist world become one again. And where this past moment of Maoist attempt at divergence from global capitalist unevenness gets reconverged with the world as a world historical logic. I conclude in a pessimistic mode that. Unless we've reached the ecological limits of our current conjunctural convergence of global capital, and that unless we grapple with that as a world historical problem, as a problem within global capitalism, we're pretty well doomed. But that's a little early to be so pessimistic. But there you go.